With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
This program is sponsored by the Kavli Foundation, based in Los Angeles, California. The Kavli Foundation is dedicated to advancing science for the benefit of humanity. I'm Alan Alda, and this is Clear and Vivid, conversations about connecting and communicating.
I'm sure you're familiar with a phrase that's very popular, which I despise, called nature versus nurture. And I despise this phrase for two reasons. The main one is that the word nurture means how your parents raised you and how they took care of you or failed to take care of you or even abused you in some cases, right? Really, that's a very narrow type of something that's much broader. I would replace it with the word experience. The other part that I hate about nature versus nurture is the versus, the idea that these things must always be in opposition, whereas in reality, they interact or even in some cases reinforce each other.
That's neuroscientist and author David Linden. He's written highly readable books about the human brain, and his latest is on the topic of what makes each of us unique. It turns out that's a question that began to intrigue him for a very personal reason. I found it fascinating, and I think you'll see why. Our conversation began by exploring the roots of our specialness, but then it took a sharp turn, again, for a very personal reason. This is going to be great because you're such a good communicator. Everybody gets the same question to start with when they have a book and they're talking to an interviewer. What made you write this book? What made you think up the subject matter? And you've got a really charming story.
Well, yeah, it is charming. The story is that I was thinking about this book as a result of internet dating, the process by which I met the woman who is now my wife. And what I realized was that when you go online and you are, you know, listing the things you like and trying to describe yourself and listing the qualities of the person that you hope to meet, that you are essentially making a list of traits. And these traits are all the things that comprise human individuality. And it, you know, gets a science nerd like me to thinking, well, which of these are heritable? Which of these come from the way you were raised? Which of them come about through other mechanisms?
So like likes to read the Sunday Times all morning is the question, whether that's inherited or the result of socialization.
Well, yeah, you know, there's so much nonsense that goes on in this particular world. And I'm sure you've seen some of it in the media. Every once in a while, you'll see a claim like, oh, there is a gene for where you fall on the political spectrum.
Yes,
or
right.
Even there is a gene for empathy. And these things are, to varying degrees, just, you know, complete and utter hogwash. So there's it's a topic where there's a lot of there's a lot of dross.
How unique are we?
As unique as we need to be. I think one way to maybe put this into perspective is to say, I think most people have heard the term identical twin, right?
Yes.
And identical twins are caused when a fertilized egg then divides before it starts growing, so that you have two presumably genetically identical fetuses, then babies, who've grown side by side in the womb. And you would imagine, well, this is about as identical as you could be. You have the same DNA, and you're growing side by side in the womb, having the same experiences during development. But nonetheless, even at birth, Identical twins, which scientists call monozygotic twins, aren't really identical, either in terms of their character or in terms of very physical things like the anatomy. So if you take two newborn identical twins and you put them in a scanner and you ask, well, what's the volume of the spleen in twin A or twin B? Well, it's not going to be exactly the same because even though they have the same genetics and they grew up side by side, there are all kinds of things that conspire to actually make them individual.
So I'm thinking of how identical the DNA must be. And yet when I think of that, I think of something I heard you say once, that there's something in nature that loves individuality. And in fact, that you called the brain a mess. I think you called it actually a freaking mess.
It sounds right.
And the idea is what? Is the idea that the brain doesn't give you an exact moment-by-moment blueprint, but the DNA sends you in general directions, or what?
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's not just for the brain, it's for everywhere in the body. But the brain's a good example because it is so complicated anatomically with so many cells and so many connections between them. So you might think, well, you know, the DNA, it has all these, 3 billion base pairs. It could make a very finely drawn wiring diagram of the entire nervous system. But that's not how it works. There actually isn't enough information, even in those 19,000 genes we have, in order to completely specify at the finest level wiring all the nerve cells together, much less specifying their very particular individual qualities. So rather, it gives a set of more general instructions. It says, hey, you neurons, I'm anthropomorphizing here. Hey, you neurons over there, you group of neurons over there, grow a little bit towards the top of the brain, and then about half of you cross the midline and keep growing out towards the ear. But in one identical twin, 40% of the neurons will cross the midline. And in another identical twin, 65% of the neurons might cross the midline. In other words, the instructions from the DNA aren't exact. There's a certain amount of stochastic variation, of pseudo-randomness that occurs during the development. And this is part of the reason why, even at birth, identical twins aren't really identical.
I think a lot of us have gotten on the wagon of believing that identical twins are really, really very identical because of instances like the occurrence of the Jim twins, which you write about in your book. Twins separated at birth, right? And both named Jim and both wound up marrying somebody with the same name, I think. I mean, it was so many similarities.
That's right. And, these sorts of things are uncanny. And, of course, they make for great copy, right? So they sell lots of newspapers and magazines. And in the case of the Jim twins, there have been many cases like this. You know, people look for the things that are similar. Oh, they have similar jobs. They marry a similar person. They drove the same car. They like to vacation at the same beach in Florida. And everyone goes, this is so amazing. Everything must be genetically determined. But of course, it isn't. I mean, you could make a very, very long list of things that are different between the Jim twins, too.
That's, I'm sure, true. But it sure makes people say, what are the odds against that?
Well, right. And at this point, we have a lot of studies of identical twins separated at birth. It's not just two or three or four. It's a couple of hundred, at least. And there was a very famous study called the Minnesota Study of Twins Reared Apart, which got abbreviated as MISTRA. And they studied both monozygotic twins reared apart and also normal fraternal twins reared apart. And they did a whole battery of tests, both psychological tests and also medical tests. And this is part of the way that we've been able to make estimates for the heritability of certain human traits. That's how we know, for example, that among people in the United States, that the trait of height is about 85% heritable. That is to say, about 85% of the variation in the trait of height is determined by the genes that you inherit from your parents. Most personality characteristics like neuroticism or openness or agreeableness or risk-taking have traits that are more in the ballpark of 30 or 40% heritable. It's not 100% like earwax type is a 100% heritable trait. It's 30 or 40%, but there's a heritable component.
As I remember from your book, some earwax is wet and some is dry.
That's right. Everyone has either wet or dry earwax.
And that's inherited.
It's 100% inherited, which makes it a very, very rare trait. And it's determined by a single gene, and we know what the gene is. So in that sense, it's a very rare trait that kind of anchors one end of the human trait spectrum. The other end of the human trait spectrum might be speech accent. Because your speech accent isn't heritable at all. Now, I'm not talking about the aspects of your voice, whether it's high or low or resonant or reedy or nasal. I'm talking about what you, your speech accent that reflects where you're from and the people who are around you when you grew up. And this is a trait that is 0% heritable. But most of our human traits, whether they're physical traits like height or behavioral traits like risk-taking, are somewhere in the middle. They are partially heritable.
What are all the factors that impinge on us other than our DNA that give us various traits?
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with a phrase that's very popular, which I despise, called nature versus nurture.
Right.
And I despise this phrase for two reasons. The main one is that the word nurture means how your parents raised you and how they took care of you or failed to take care of you or even abused you in some cases, right? Really, that's a very narrow type of something that's much broader. I would replace it with the word experience. And by experience, I don't just mean social experience. I mean the foods you ate when you were growing up, the foods your mother ate when she was carrying you in utero, the diseases your mother fought off when she was carrying you in utero, the day length, the latitude of the place where you spent your early years. These are all things that can influence traits. And that's experience broadly considered. The other part that I hate about nature versus nurture is the versus, the idea that these things must always be in opposition. Whereas in reality, they interact or even in some cases reinforce each other. For example, if you're fortunate enough to be born strong and coordinated, then you're much more likely to play sports and practice sports and get better at sports and become even better at sports than you were when you were young. And in this case, your experience of playing sports and your genetics, which might have made you faster coordinated, are actually working together. They're not in a versus situation. They collaborate and reinforce each other to make you a better athlete.
What's the outcome of all of this? How does it apply to our lives? I mean, I can imagine an application of the uniqueness of everybody in communication. When we try to communicate with someone, especially someone we don't agree with, it doesn't help to think we're talking to this type of person. We have to find out who the person is in discrete detail to really get to them, to really communicate with them. We have to acknowledge their uniqueness. But that's sort of an analogy. What do you think are the outcomes we can get from this study of uniqueness?
Well, I think there are a couple. I would say in the medical realm, I think understanding human uniqueness is going to be important to improve medicine. In other words, we already know that you can inherit certain genetic variants that will make it that a certain drug will work or not work for you. So you may have heard the term personalized medicine.
Mm.
Well, some of personalized medicine is going to reflect things like your particular DNA, but there will also be personalized medicine that reflects what we call epigenetic factors, which is not the sequence of bases in your DNA, but the way certain genes have been turned on or off by the attachment of chemical groups to the DNA. And that is something that happens as a result of your experience in the world. In other words, epigenetics is the link between experience and DNA. So one way in which uniqueness is important is going to be to make medicine better, to make therapies that are more tailored to individuals. I think in terms of the way our society works, an understanding of individuality and human traits is probably most important in terms of addressing the scourge of racism.
Mm.
I mean, when you see the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville marching, they're not holding up banners about the heritability of traits, but it is that ideology that ultimately underlies what they do. In other words, they say certain groups are genetically inferior to others. You know, for the people in Charlottesville, they might say, well, yeah, so white people are genetically superior to black people or brown people. And it doesn't matter how much you make things equitable in terms of the way people live and their access to education or safety or being treated fairly in the workplace or in school, because these differences will still exist because they're hardwired into our DNA. And all the evidence from genetics is against this idea. There is no group of genes that you can point to that says, well, this makes this group of people smarter or this group of people more violent or this group of people braver, for example. That is nonsense. It doesn't exist. And I think on the social level, that's the most important thing you can take from the scientific study of individuality.
How about you personally? Have your attitudes gone through an evolution?
Well, yeah. What it has left me with, I think, is with an enhanced sense of empathy. Let me give an example. I think these days, more and more people are willing to accept the notion that addiction is a disease, that it's not merely a moral failing. You know, when you go into the doctor and you say, I have heart disease, your doctor doesn't say, oh, you suck, you have heart disease, there's something wrong with you. And these days, there aren't that many doctors who will say that if you're an addict too. However, if you're overweight, that's a different story. Both people in the general world and most doctors have a very moralistic attitude towards body size. And we know that body mass index, or some people don't like that measure, but whatever is the best possible measure of fat burden in a body, is a highly heritable trait. It's on the order of 60 or 70%. It's a big chunk of it is heritable. And yet, as a society, we're not very compassionate to people who struggle with this. Not nearly as compassionate as we are for people who struggle with addiction, and not even remotely as compassionate as we are for people who struggle with, say, something like schizophrenia, which is the most heritable neuropsychiatric condition that we have. So I would say, if there's anything that I have been led to in my own way of thinking and my own way of interacting with people, is that you've got to be empathetic and compassionate when you consider these kinds of situations.
When we come back from our break, David Linden tells me how he received a diagnosis of cancer, giving him only months to live, and how that caused the neuroscientist in him to reflect on how our brains handle terrible news. He has some fascinating insights. right after this. This program is sponsored by the Kavli Foundation, dedicated to advancing science for the benefit of humanity. The Foundation's mission is to stimulate scientific research in astrophysics, theoretical physics, nanoscience, and neuroscience to strengthen the relationship between science and society, and to honor scientific discoveries with the Kavli Prize. This is Clear and Vivid, and now back to my conversation with David Linden. The notion of how unique we are is interesting to me, especially because of your recent history. I'm trying to tread lightly here, but you wrote about your diagnosis in an article in Atlantic, and it really is something I'd like to talk about with you, if it's okay.
It's certainly okay.
When did you get the diagnosis of this terrible case of cancer?
So I got a diagnosis of my cancer after having surgery just about a year ago.
And it's one of those diagnoses where they give you a time and a date.
Well, yeah, they do. They do their best. The kind of cancer that I have, which is called synovial sarcoma, is a relatively rare cancer. And it's also where it is presenting in my body, which is in my heart, is a relatively rare place. So it's not one of these situations where the doctors have lots and lots of statistics to go on when they are trying to make your lifespan prognosis. If you look in the medical literature, they're not tables of the results of what's happened in thousands and thousands of cases. Rather, they're mostly isolated case reports. And so it's not surprising that their guesses are pretty vague, but 12 months ago, I was given 6 to 18 months to live. I think I'll probably go a little longer than 18 months, given that I'm doing just fine and I'm 12 months in.
You seem hardy. Is the treatment not invasive?
Well, no. There are times where I haven't been hardy. So the treatment was rather dramatic. It involved open heart surgery and the excision of a tumor the size of a Coke can that had grown into the wall of my heart. And because it had grown into the wall of my heart, it couldn't be entirely removed or else they would make my heart so that it couldn't function anymore. And so they took as much as they could. They left behind what they had to leave. And then they treated what was left with both radiation and chemotherapy. And of course, those are things that make you feel real ill. So there have been periods where I felt real lousy, as people tend to do under that sort of treatment. But those treatments are over. And so right now, I'm feeling pretty chipper.
And you certainly appear so. I was really interested to see that the piece you wrote was organized around the idea that you weren't an ordinary civilian approaching this diagnosis. You were thinking about it as a scientist, and you came up with three realizations that I thought were really fascinating.
Well, thank you. And I think one thing you have to realize is that when you are a biomedical researcher like myself, and you go to the doctor, the way you get treated at the doctor is not the way an average civilian gets treated at the doctor, in the sense that they know that I'm really interested in all the medical details. So, for example, my surgeon comes up with this big grin on his face. He says, "I took movies on my iPhone during your heart surgery. You want to see them?" And, of course, being a geek, I'm like, yeah, I want to see those. That's why we're looking and go, ooh, what's that? You know? Yeah.
I had an operation on my intestines, and the doctor wanted to show me my guts in video afterwards, and I was just as curious as you were.
Good. Well, you see, I think there is something to, I mean, obviously everyone has to find their own way in this situation, and there's no universal right or wrong. But for me, being engaged with the medicine and the science of my own cancer is a way to feel a sense of agency. It's a way to not be powerless and not to be entirely buffeted by, you know, the ill winds of fate. So to me, it's crucial that my curiosity keeps going as I think about my situation as someone with a bad cancer prognosis. And you mentioned the three things, so maybe I'll start talking about what those are. The first realization that I had, which really I think for most people wouldn't be a realization, I just kind of had it because I'm a little thick and it took a lot to bring this home to me. And that is the notion that you really can occupy two highly different mental states at the same time, two different emotions.
Like
so
what?
For example, well, when I consider the situation of my cancer and my prognosis, I am both simultaneously furious, you know, that I am going to be taken away from all this wonderful life that I have, you know, with people I love and colleagues and friends. But I'm also so grateful for all life has given me. I'm simultaneously angry and feeling a sense of gratitude. I mean, by any one measure, I've had a terrific life. I've had wonderful people around me. I've had the opportunity in my work and my writing to follow my own curiosity. And that's a gift like no other.
And the implication of that sounds to me that it may be encouragement to somebody who's feeling mostly the anger to realize they can still keep feeling angry, but they can feel gratitude at the same time.
Absolutely. These things should not be considered mutually exclusive. And I think some of the fault of this actually goes to my field, which is neuroscience. And that is, we classically have said, oh, well, what kind of mode is the brain in? Are we in a fight mode or a flight mode? Do we want to, you know, fight or flee, or do we want to, you know, rest and digest? And this kind of idea that the brain sort of switches back between binary modes really doesn't capture the complexity, I think, of human cognitive states or of human emotions. So, that was sort of the first revelation I had.
And the second had to do with the brain not being able to measure absolute value.
Yeah, and this is something that I think really has become a theme in neuroscience in the last 30 years or so. And that is, the brain is not built to give us the lowdown about the external world, to give us the most accurate representation of reality. From the first moment that we're aware of sensory experience, it is being convolved with our past history, with our expectations, and with context, in order for us to have an emotional feeling about it. Emotion and perception aren't separate things. They're deeply intertwined at the very first moments of perception. It's not as just, we can take in objective information and then only later do we begin to put an emotional gloss on it. No, that's not the way it works. From the very first moment you perceive things through any of your senses, whether it is it's touch or sight or smell or hearing, there is an emotional and a contextual aspect to that.
Yeah, the contextual aspect really came home to me when you talked about being happy with getting a raise at your work until you find out what the guy next to you is getting.
That's right. We can't help but compare ourselves. You know, this is right. You're not supposed to covet your neighbor's donkey, right? There's a biblical injunction, right?
But if he has two donkeys, the bets are off.
But, you know, this is a deeply human thing. And people have done brain scanning experiments where they have a setup where you're winning a certain amount of money. And you would think, well, 10 bucks is 10 bucks is 10 bucks. And that should correspond to a certain amount of activation of the reward circuitry in the brain. But if you're winning 10 bucks and the guy next to you is winning 100 bucks, well, the activation of the reward circuitry in your brain is not nearly as intense. We are naturally comparative. Another example of this kind of subjectivity in perception, I think, comes from the sense of touch. So imagine you're with your sweetheart, and it's a loving, connected time, and you're feeling good, and they give you a nice caress on the arm, and you go, oh, that's nice. Oh, yeah, yeah, what a nice thing. That feels good. Now imagine instead you're with your sweetie, and it's an argument, and it's in the middle, and it's not resolved. You're going back and forth, and you're both with each other, and they give you that same caress, and it doesn't feel the same at all. It feels unwanted. It feels almost like a violation, like there's a bug on there. Get that hand off of me. What do you mean? We're in the middle of an argument. Now, it's the exact same caress. It's the same pressure on your arm in the same place, you know, for the same time with the same temperature given by the same person, but it feels completely different from the very first moment it occurs. And this, to me, is a great example about how perception is inference. And the way this was brought home to me in terms of my cancer diagnosis was how I thought about lifespan. If before my diagnosis, when I was 59 years old, if someone had said to me, oh, you got 5 years to live, I would have gone, oh, no, 5 years, how unfair. I'm not ready to die. That's too soon. Only 5 years, that's terrible. Now, with my diagnosis, if you said, you got 5 years to live, I would say, hooray, I'd be clicking my heels together, going, that's wonderful. I could do so much in 5 years. I could have so many good times. I could be with my people. I could get work done. I could travel. I could save her life. So, you know, I would have something as fundamental as 5 years of life still is perceived very differently depending on the context. And that's been brought home to me by my situation.
And that leads very much to the third realization, which I find the most interesting of all. Because I've always wondered why none of us, it seems almost to a person, wants to think about our death. When in fact, it's the one thing we all have in common. No matter who we are, we have a limited time. And we don't want to think about it. And your third realization really gets into that, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it goes beyond just sort of wanting to think about it, maybe a little further to what we're capable of imagining.
Yeah.
Right? And what I find is that I am not really capable of engaging in a really deep or meaningful way with the idea of my own demise or the prospect of a world without me in it. Now, of course, I can do all the practical things. I can, you know, meet with a lawyer about my will, and I can write the reference letters for the people in my lab so when I'm gone, they have those to move on with their career. And, you know, I can write letters to my friends and my kids. And, you know, this is all nuts and bolts stuff. But in terms of really deeply thinking about myself gone, I find my mind sort of skittering over the surface of it. And I don't think it is really something about me personally. I think that this is something deeply human and cross-cultural and cross-individual that we share. And I think the reason comes from something fundamental about how the brain works. Now, I've been a brain researcher for many years now, more than 40 years. And when I started in brain research, we had this idea that the brain was fundamentally reactive, that it sat there, something would come in through the senses, the brain would process it, maybe make a decision, and then you'd maybe make a movement or move your vocal cords to produce speech. And it was essentially a reactive model of the brain. And what we now know is that that's much more accurate, that the brain is fundamentally predictive, that a lot of the effort of the brain is trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future. And really, mostly in the very near future. Like, is that baseball flying through the air going to hit my head? Is this person walking down the street who I'm coming alongside, friend or foe? Am I likely to become hungry soon? And these are things that happen continuously and subconsciously. We can't turn them off. Our mind is going to do it all the time. And I think because we are hardwired to be predicting the future, that presupposes that there will be the future.
That's the part I love.
And that's what makes it so hard to truly engage with our own demise. And what I believe is that this is not just an issue for individuals, but it's an issue for societies. And you know, if I'm to get speculative, what I would say is that, you know, if you look around the world, there cultural anthropologists will tell you that there is religious thought everywhere. Everywhere you go around the world, there's religious thought. Not everyone has it, but you can find it in every single culture, everywhere. A lot of times people don't call it that. They just say, well, of course, this is just stuff everybody knows is true. But these are what scientists would call non-naturalistic explanations. They're articles of faith. And while not every single religion has the idea of an afterlife or reincarnation or fusion with the divine after you die, most of the world's religions do. And I think the reason they do, my speculation, is that the reason that this is so popular all around the world is because of this neurobiological quirk, because our brains are built as prediction machines, and we can't imagine a situation where there isn't a near future. We create these constructions in which our consciousness endures, and these become the basis of the world's religions.
Well, this has been a unique conversation in every way. Thank you for that. Before we go, we always end our show with seven quick questions.
Oh, my.
Roughly to do with communication, and in a very general way. First question, what do you wish you really understood?
I wish that I really understood human memory and how it was stored in the brain and how it works and generalizes and fails. This has been, more than anything else, the focus of my scientific work for 40 years or so now. And it's a topic where we still are mostly in the dark.
How do you tell someone they have their facts wrong?
that's rough. You know, particularly in if these facts have gotten politicized. I think so much of communication, and you know, you as someone who's dedicated so much of your life to this practice, knows that fundamentally, communicating, whether it's about science or anything else, is an empathetic act. You have to put yourself in the mindset of the person who doesn't know what you know or doesn't feel what you feel, who doesn't share your experience. So when I'm trying to tell someone their facts are wrong, I try to think, how can I do this in a way that isn't going to just yield defensiveness? You know, if I were receiving this information, what is something that could possibly persuade me?
Great. How do you stop a compulsive talker?
Turn off their microphone.
Okay. Let's say you're sitting at a dinner table next to someone you don't know. How do you start up a genuine conversation?
Yeah, you know, I wish I was better at that, honestly. You know, I am one of these people who is, I call it a performance introvert. In the sense that, you know, when I'm in a situation like with this, with you, I don't have any problem running my mouth a lot because I'm the focus. It's a very set up situation. But, you know, in a dinner party with strangers, I have a lot harder time doing this. I'm very envious of people who can do this. You know, I tend to turn to things that are rather stock and you know, often not compelling, and it doesn't always work. I wouldn't say this is not something in which my advice is very good, because I don't feel like I've really succeeded at it.
Okay, well, maybe the next time we meet, you'll have a technique you've developed.
Yeah,
from thinking about it. Next to last, what gives you confidence?
What gives me confidence? You know, I think ultimately confidence is a social construction. I'm fortunate to have a very supportive home environment, to have a very supportive work environment. And it's supportive not just in the sense of people are nice to me, but that people are challenging and constructive in the best way. When my children were small, my son at about age 7 asked, "Dad, are you the best neuroscientist in the world?" And I said, "Oh, certainly not." He said, "Oh, well, are you at the best neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins?" And I said, "No, not even remotely." I said, "Jacob, I'm not even the best neuroscience on the 9th floor of the Hunterian building at Johns Hopkins." I said, "I'm fortunate enough to be around people who impress me every day and challenge me every day and who expand my mind every day." And that environment, to me, is the bedrock of my confidence.
Great, great. Last question. What book changed your life?
Wow. I'm trying to remember the title of it. It was a children's book. And it was Homer Price. So Homer Price is a children's book about a young boy, and it's set in Ohio in a fictional town. And there's a story in this book called Ever So Much, But More So. And in this story, there's this compound called Ever So Much, But More So. And whatever you pour it on, it becomes more intense. So if you pour it on a chocolate bar and you eat it, then it becomes the most chocolatey chocolate bar you've ever had. But of course, you can imagine what happened. People in the town start eating it, and then all their characteristics become that much more exaggerated. And when I read this story as a young child, I thought, you know, could that happen? That's remarkable. I want to study the brain. I want to understand mental function. I want to understand what could possibly make us ever so much but more so, and how we get to be the way we are to start with, even before such a compound could act.
So even as a boy, you were fascinated by traits.
You know, that really was formative for me.
Well, this conversation has been formative for me in a couple of ways. I really admire your take on life, and I'm sure people listening will have got a good jolt of the same kind of empathy you were talking about, as well as confidence in the future we all face. I thank you for that. I thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been loads of fun.
It sure has. Thank you, David. This has been Clear and Vivid. At least I hope so. My thanks to the Kavli Foundation for sponsoring this episode. The Kavli Foundation is dedicated to advancing science for the benefit of humanity. David Linden is professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He's written books on the evolution of the brain and how the brain perceives touch and pleasure. His most recent book is unique, The New Science of Human Individuality. His essay on receiving his cancer diagnosis appeared in the December 30th issue of Atlantic Magazine. His webpage is davidlinden.org. This episode was edited and produced by our executive producer, Graham Chedd, with help from our associate producer, Gene Chimay. Our publicist is Sarah Hill. Our researcher is Elizabeth Ohini, and the sound engineer is Erica Huang. The music is courtesy of the Stefan Koenig Trio. You can subscribe to our podcast for free at Apple, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. Next in our series of conversations, I talk with Kashmir Hill. She's a reporter for the New York Times, where she writes about how the technologies that are making our lives easier are also eroding our privacy. And she takes an engagingly personal approach.
You know, my Amazon Echo, the smart speaker, was basically talking to Amazon every 3 minutes, just sending a ping to Amazon. Even when we weren't using it, even when it was muted, it's still sending data back and forth to the company. My TV was reporting what we were watching. My robot vacuum was sending information back to the company. And the company has actually talked about how useful that data could be. They said, you know, we have basically maps of people's homes. We could tell, you know, a furniture company that they lack a coffee table, and you could start targeting them with coffee table ads. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think about what kind of data you can get about people if you're in their homes, seeing what they're doing day to day, because everything we have is connected to the internet.
Kashmir Hill and how she even used technology to track her husband. Fortunately, he played along with it. Next time on Clear and Vivid. For more details about Clear and Vivid and to sign up for my newsletter, please visit alanalda.com. And you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Clear and Vivid, and I'm on Twitter at Alan Alda. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.